When the Berlin Wall fell, the whole world hoped for a new era of peace and reconciliation.
And so, fast forward 30 years, and I wanted to retrace what went wrong. So I did the same journey, but backwards. I went from Moscow to Berlin, of course, through many of the cities in between and countries in between, and on to Brexit Britain, asking what became of our faith in the power of openness and reconciliation, and why had the Kremlin redoubled its efforts to undermine Western unity, and why, of course, back to this, why so many of us have fallen for the populist spin, dragging democracy to this precarious moment.
That's Rory MacLean. His book about Europe and the fall of the Berlin Wall was Stalin's Nose. He's back 30 years later with a sequel. It's called Pravda Ha-Ha, True Travels to the End of Europe. Then the COVID-19 pandemic has crashed the world oil market. That might be a good thing for U.S. consumers, but could it be causing a global food crisis?
The decline in oil prices is going to lead to widespread poverty and hunger in many of the oil-producing countries. It's an odd impact of this that we rarely think about.
That's energy analyst and defense correspondent for The Nation, Michael Clare. He tells us about his latest article for The Nation, COVID-19's Third Shockwave, the Global Food Crisis. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. And hey, do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our free podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. In 1989, the Berlin Wall fell. In that euphoric year, Rory MacLean traveled from Berlin to Moscow, exploring lands that were, for most Brits and Americans, part of the forgotten half of Europe. 30 years on, MacLean traces his original journey backwards, across countries confronting old ghosts and new fears, from revanchist Russia through Ukraine's bloodlands into illiberal Hungary, and then on to Poland, Germany, and the UK. Along the way, MacLean goes hunting with Moscow's chicken czar, plays video games in St. Petersburg with a cyber hacker who cracked the U.S. election, and finally, on the shores of Lake Geneva, waits patiently to chat with Mikhail Gorbachev. As Europe sleepwalks into a perilous new age, MacLean explores how opportunists, both within and outside Russia, from Putin to home country's populists, have made a joke of truth, exploiting refugees and the dispossessed. He asks what happened to the optimism of 1989, and in the shadow of Brexit, he chronicles the collapse of the European dream. In addition to Pravda Ha-Ha, Rory MacLean is the author of more than a dozen books, including Stalin's Nose and Under the Dragon. I spoke with him on January 31st, the day that the UK formally exited the European Union. Rory MacLean, hello.
Mrs. Francesca, it's so great to be invited on Writer's Voice. Thank you very much.
Thank you for writing this absolutely terrific book. It's not just a wonderfully written book and fascinating in its stories, but I feel the message of it is just so important and it struck deeply into my heart.
You could not have said anything nicer to me. I think it is such a interesting and such a dangerous time we're living through, and it's so important to me that people know what is happening.
Absolutely. And so, well, without any further ado, I want to welcome you, Rory MacLean, to Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca. It's really a pleasure to be here.
You know, what's so interesting is that we are talking today on January 31st, which is Brexit Day.
Indeed. It has been such a remarkable, deluded, confusing 3 years since David Cameron, the former Prime Minister, but two, decided he would quiet down the Eurosceptics in his Conservative Party and just do a referendum, propose a referendum about Britain leaving the UK. God, and I saw a fact today, you know, it was supposedly all about taking back control. We've heard that before. And all about saving money. Well, evidently, since that referendum was called and in all the back and forth since then, the United Kingdom, the UK, has spent the same amount of money that it contributed to the EU over the last 30 years. It's just shocking. It's just shocking. And people just, well, it's really so interesting, I think, because people now really want simplistic. The problems we face are very complicated. Many, many problems in society, in our leadership, in the environment, of course. And people, especially individuals who suffered after the 2008 financial crash, they want certainties. They want, if you like, simple answers to these very complicated questions. And we need to be, we so need to be wary of oversimplification, not to fall for simple soundbite answers.
That is so true. And yet there are also, in some ways, I'd have to say there are some simple answers, and that is that if we think of the Golden Rule, for example.
Yes.
If we think about social solidarity, if we think yes. about how we are all on this planet together, there are some very simple guiding things, and that, you know, is really a return to ethics and to truth, which is very much what the subject of this book is, Truth and Lies. Pravda, haha. Well, let's start there. First, pravda has a double meaning that's completely apt for this book. Tell us about that.
Well, a double meaning. Pravda in Russian means truth. And it was actually, during the communist years, it was the official newspaper of, one of the official newspapers of the Communist Party. And the other newspaper was Izvestia, which means news. And during communist years, the Russians used to joke that there's no truth in Pravda and no news in Izvestia. You've got it, Francesca. You've really got it. What I wanted people to do in reading this in this book, I just hoped they would start to ask questions. They would question what is true of the stories I'm being told, of the myths.
The truth and the myths, exactly. You know, and first we should give some context to our listeners now. This is a book that you wrote 30 years after writing another book. That book was Stalin's Nose, is that right?
That's absolutely right. I you're talking about the principles that should guide us. So 30 years ago, as you and your listeners know, the Berlin Wall fell. And in November 89, I was there and I traveled from Berlin to Moscow. And it was a time of such euphoria, such openness, and really, how could it not be otherwise? My generation, I'm in my 60s, I'd grown up in the shadow of World War II with 60 million dead and with half a continent behind the wall and behind a wall. And our response, of course, was to value individual liberty over tribalism, perhaps even to imagine an end of borders in Europe. And so fast forward 30 years, and I wanted to retrace what went wrong. So I did the same journey, but backwards. I went from Moscow to Berlin, of course, through many of the cities in between and countries in between, and on to Brexit Britain, asking what became of our faith in the power of openness and reconciliation, and why had the Kremlin redoubled its efforts to undermine Western unity, and why, of course, back to this, why so many of us have fallen for the populist spin, dragging democracy to this precarious moment.
Yes, and I'm sure some reasons are shared, you know, across the globe, perhaps. But there are very particular reasons in this region that you treat here. And one of them is shame. The shame of the failure of the fall of the Soviet Union, for example, or in other countries, the shame that they also feel at having, you know, lost some mythic or fabled might or power in the past that has led to where they are today. So I wonder, Talk about shame as a driver for the kind of acceptance of these lies and myths about, you know, that lead to xenophobia and intolerance.
As you say, in the early 1990s, the Soviet Union collapsed. And I don't think we appreciate how traumatic that was for ordinary Russians. The gross domestic product fell by 50%. That's more than in the U.S. during the 1929 crash. Bank savings were wiped out. Male life expectancy crashed to 57 years. And of course, since 1917, most Russians had lived with this dream, this myth, this illusion of the ultimate success of Soviet communism. And it was the end of the illusion. There was no people's utopia. And so, of course, what happened is there was a gap that was created. And into this gap stepped individuals who were willing to tell stories, to manipulate the nostalgia that was growing in the Soviet people. And they started, Soviets began to deify Stalin. And school textbooks talked about the glory of the Red Army. Gulags, if you can believe it, official Russian information, I'm not going to say propaganda, information called the gulags, quote, the unavoidable cost of modernization. So Russians fell in their despair, in their trauma. It was a nation in trauma. They fell for leaders who told them a single emotive story.
Yes, and one of these leaders is, of course, Vladimir Putin. But before we get to him, I want to get there by way of this Russian oligarch who you open this book with, who led you to something called Putin's Pecker.
Can we say this on American radio? I don't know. Indeed, that is the actual term I was told. This is Dmitry Denisovich, Russia's chicken czar. And his story is one of these remarkable stories from the collapse of the Soviet Union. Because as we know today, there are many oligarchs in Russia. And they had connections in 1991, 92, 93. They had a cousin in the KGB. They had a friend in the government. And they used those connections and they were really sharp operators. And Dmitry, you may remember that right after the collapse of the Soviet Union, George Bush, the first George Bush, and Gorbachev, well, George Bush decided he wanted to help Russians. And so he donated beautiful American chicken, thighs and legs to Russia, millions of tons of them. And these became known, these gifts became known as bush legs. And if you can imagine the Soviet chicken from the communist days, it was sort of rather scrawny, a bit blue maybe. And in came these big, phosphate-filled, thick American drumsticks. And the Russians loved them. And Dmitry Denisovich, he was involved in the early days of importing. And eventually, of course, the gifting from the United States stopped. And he was one of the individuals who cornered the market. He started importing them himself and selling them. And at that time, Russians would pay almost anything for bush legs. So he made his money on bush legs. And I think he said after a couple of weeks, he bought his first handheld telephone, not a mobile or a cell phone, but, you know, one of the cordless telephones. After 3 or 4 weeks, he bought his first apartment. After a year, I think he had a dozen apartments. He had a yacht. And his story, it's one of the stories I tell about the oligarchs, because we haven't heard, I think, the true stories of many of these oligarchs and how they seize these opportunities. And of course, they profited. The reason that many Russians became or remained disillusioned is because individuals like Dmitry, in effect, stole from them. They profited from them.
Yes, exactly. And we should tell our listeners that Putin's Pecker is actually a fungus, like a kind of truffle, actually.
Yes, that's right.
That is exceedingly prized and rare and exceedingly expensive. So in that way, kind of an expression of the kind of lifestyle that these oligarchs live, who must be some of the richest people in the world.
Oh, indeed. Moscow, you know, supposed to be the capital of equality of all men and women, it's now the most, it has more billionaires than any other city in the world, including New York. And 28 years ago, that was not the case.
And if you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Rory MacLean, great travel writer, about his latest book, Pravda Haha, True Travels to the End of Europe. And there's a double entendre with the end of Europe, which we'll get to in a little bit. But this oligarch has an aide who lost her father on the day of her birth in the bombing of an apartment house. And I think this really kind of is an emblematic story of how Putin transformed Russia into the kleptocracy and dictatorship that it is. Tell us about it.
Well, this is his assistant, one of his many assistants, Anna, and her story illustrates how, not for the first time in history, a leader or a prospective leader has decided to create enemies, to create the illusion of an enemy. Now, I have to say, and I say this very clearly in the book, this is not proven, but the stories, it seems to be true from all the sides that I've heard it, apart, of course, from the official side. And this story is that when President Putin first stepped forward as a potential presidential candidate, there happened very soon afterwards four or five terrible, terrible explosions in apartment buildings in Moscow and in surrounding cities. And President Putin, who was then a almost unknown minor bureaucrat, well, middle-ranking bureaucrat, he had been head of the KGB, but that's another story. He appeared on television and he said, "Terrorists, we are going to catch these terrorists and we'll rub them out. If we find them in a toilet at the airport, we will rub them out." That's what he said. And his popularity soared because he said it was Chechen terrorists who had planted these bombs, which actually had killed Anna's father. But it's rather difficult to get certain types of explosive in central Moscow and in Russia. And I have it from a number of reliable sources that the only way, the only source of this very specific explosive, which was used in the underneath these apartment blocks, which killed hundreds of people, these explosions, is only available from or with the KGB. And there is a story that a KGB registered car was seen driving away from one of the stories. The KGB officers who were supposedly in it, they mysteriously died within 6 months. And it may not be true, and certainly President Putin denies it totally. He said, "This is absolute rubbish. The KGB conspire against the Russian people. You must be mad." But there are the facts. There were four or five terrorist attacks. He stood up against them. He said, "We will capture these damn terrorists." He started doing that with the Chechen War, and he became president. Well, go figure.
Yeah, and what's so striking is what happens when you actually tell this story to the oligarch's aide, a young woman named Anna. So, you know, what did she say that got you into the discussion? And then what was her response when you told her what you just told us?
Well, she said it was fake news. She said it was fake news. It wasn't true. And imagine, Francesca, if you have been told one narrative, one story all your adult life, you come to accept that. And if you fall for the propaganda, the portrayal of your leader as a flawless patriot, it would be very, very difficult. And certainly Anna found it difficult to accept this. So she thought that in me telling her the story that I knew, she thought that I was lying.
And do Russians know that Putin is possibly the richest man on earth?
What did one man say to me? He said, "Politics in Russia is that you cast your vote and then don't think about it for another 4 or 5 years."
So talk about that. You know, so many people, refer to democracy For example, they'll say that, they'll say Brazil is a democracy. They'll say that the United States is a democracy. They'll say that Britain is a democracy. What does a democracy really mean? And so what are the stages of the slippery slope that you've seen us go down?
You know, I think it begins with individuals who are willing to ignore their humanity in their ambition to gain power. I find it so difficult to watch the Hungarian Prime Minister Orban or the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, or indeed the American president, to lather up a crowd of supporters by denigrating the pillars of representative democracy. That's, of course, Parliament, Congress, the courts, the civil service, and trashing its institutions like academia and the press, and slandering the law and the truth, saying things are fake news. It's a, what was that term? Alternative, was it alternative truth or alternative reality?
Alternative facts.
Alternative facts, for goodness sake. You cannot say that. That's a lie. And so I think that's the starting point. That's the slippery slope. And so many of us on both sides of the Atlantic, across Europe, many of us want simplistic answers to complicated problems. Well, of course, we have a desire for clarity, but we mistakenly equate clarity with simplification. And that's a grave, grave error.
And of course, as you point out, what this leads to is a loss of our humanity towards others, as seen no more greatly than how we treat immigrants in this country and in Russia. You have such a powerful story about a young man named Sammy, and I don't know how much of the story you'd like to reveal because there's a lot of suspense in it, but tell us what you can about Sammy and how his story illustrates, you know, the other side from the oligarch of you know, the fallout of these kinds of regimes.
Well, in a way, Francesca, this Pravda Haha is a snapshot, a portrait of Europe today and the forces that are affecting us over here and indeed you in the US. So I've included in the book the story of three migrants, because migrants are so much a part of life in the West. We in the West, in the first world countries, we are so lucky with what we have and what our forefathers and foremothers have created. And of course, there are many in the world who haven't been so lucky, many, many individuals who want some of that, who want to improve their life. But of course, no one chooses to be a refugee. No one chooses to leave Somalia or Guatemala or Nigeria or Syria to risk their lives to travel to Europe. There's I tell one of the three stories of migrant stories I tell is a young Syrian, a young swimmer, and she was in Damascus, and she said her choice was, do I stay home and die, or do I try to make it to Europe and maybe die? And Sammy's story, Sammy is a Nigerian, and he managed to come into a small amount of money, enough to buy an air ticket. And at the time, the easiest way to get into Europe was because the Mediterranean routes had become difficult, almost impossible to use. He flew from Nigeria to Mexico and then to Spain and then on to Moscow. And he'd never been in an aircraft before, and he risked everything so he could make a new start, support his family back at home. He would infinitely have preferred to be back in Nigeria, but it wasn't possible. And so I won't reveal too much of his story, but I met him in Moscow, and then again, he was successful. I met him in England at the end of his journey. So he did manage to get into the EU as he wanted to do.
Well, one thing I wanted to ask you is, you helped him because his story was just absolutely heartrending. And you know, typically a journalist or a writer is not supposed to help of the people that they're writing about. And I've always kind of wondered about this, because how can you not try to help somebody who's in dire need and you're the only one who can help them? So I wonder if you could share some of the thoughts that you might have struggled, that you might have had as you were deciding to help him.
Well, I think it would be fair to say that I tried to help him and I was rather useless. You know, my main calling is to write books, but I also do travel writing from time to time, and an editor at the newspaper I work with sometimes, he's crazy about cruises. And Sammy and I were in St. Petersburg at the time, and there are many cruises, like these elegant, beautiful ships, hugely expensive cruises that come into St. Petersburg and then go across the Baltic and to the UK. And so I thought, oh, I'll get a commission and smuggle Sammy onto the ship. Well, that was a bit of a dream. And in the end, he just helped himself. I did give him some money. I did give him what I could afford. So to answer your question, it's always a really very difficult call, because if you like, as a professional, I don't want my presence to affect to any large extent the individual I'm writing about. I want to portray him or her as honestly, as accurately as possible for the readers, because if you like, I'm a surrogate. I'm a proxy for my readers. I'm there for my readers. So I don't want to manipulate things too much. But then your humanity kicks in. And if I could give him a couple of $100, and if it could improve his chances or just enable him to survive for a week or two, which you could do in Russia for a couple of $100, then I could not do it.
Well, Rory McLean, so let's move on a little bit more, because there's another story also here. You went to St. Petersburg to talk to a source that you found there who worked for the Internet Research Agency, the one that was responsible, that interfered with the 2016 election.
Yes.
And with Brexit. So talk about her, another moral dilemma, actually. I mean, in this wonderful book about truth and lies, there's also the dilemmas that ordinary people face all the time as to whether they're going to participate in something that is horrific just because it's the only way they can survive. So tell us that story.
Indeed. It has democracy been undermined for the cost of a few free lunches? As you say, this was set up about 10 years ago, maybe a little more. Russia had no money, or it had very little money. It had a few new weapons, but really it had nothing like the wealth of its main adversary, the United States. And so one of the generals in President Putin's defense council, he said, what we need is a weapon that is very cheap, almost free of charge, but can affect a huge number of people, as can nuclear weapons. And they hit on this idea of creating the Internet Research Agency, which specifically tried to influence and undermine democracy. It worked initially. It had a go at the Baltic states. Estonia was its first target. Then it closed down TV5, the French television network. It shut down power systems in Ukraine. It was just getting into the swing of things. And then, of course, as is well known, in the 2016 election, presidential election, this organization posted 80,000 Facebook posts and tweets and everything seen by 126 million Americans. And they provided simple answers to these complicated questions. And it was saying during the Brexit referendum, 3,800 fake accounts with the hashtag reasons to leave EU were posted, seen by I'm not sure how many Brits. But the objective was to sow distrust, to exacerbate division, and to discredit truth. And the technique wasn't new. It's a technique that has been used by Lenin and Stalin. It just was applied to us in the West.
So now to this source, tell us about her and how she came to you.
So during my research into the Internet Research Agency, I wanted to speak to somebody who'd worked there. And of course, one jumps to the conclusion, one assumes that such an individual would be very hardline, politically right or left, very politically active. And the woman who agreed to meet me, and this was it was arranged through a mutual acquaintance, but I met her in St. Petersburg. She was a young Jewish woman and trained as a telecoms engineer. And after the collapse of the Soviet Union, she, like so many others, lost her job, but she gained freedom and she loved to travel. And she traveled, she took across Europe, there's many long distance bus routes. And boy, from Moscow, it's a long drive to Western Europe. But she would go to Prague, to Budapest, even to Tel Aviv, just to travel. Because in those early days, this is in the early 2000s, she wanted to discover the world. She lived for traveling. But she couldn't get a proper job. She couldn't get a long-term job. And then she saw this ad in a St. Petersburg newspaper advertising for workers at the Internet Research Agency. And at the end of the ad, it says, great location and free lunches. And she applied. And because she spoke fluent English, she was given a job there. And her job, as for the numbers changed at one point, there were 80 people working there. At another point, there were 600. It went up and down depending on what activities they were doing and where. There was a Canadian department. There was, of course, American and British department. There was a French department. And linguists, like this young woman, would post critical comments about one politician and then about another. And in Germany, for example, they would support far left and the next day support far right. And they have a way, and this is going outside my ken, but they had a way to influence the Google algorithms. And so when they would post it on just their fake Facebook or Twitter feed, then there were bots who would post it many, many, many more times on lots of other Twitter accounts. And then the algorithms at Google would pick up this post as having a go at, let's say, Hillary Clinton. It must be important because many people are looking at it. And so they would then make it climb up the ratings on the Google search engine. And so this was specifically was to sow distrust, exacerbate division, and to discredit truth. And the terrible thing, the great irony of it all, is eventually she was fired because they did start hiring more politically active individuals, younger individuals. She was 40 and thought her life was over at 40. That's what she said. And she couldn't travel anymore because she had worked at the Internet Research Agency. She was not allowed under Russian law to travel.
Rory MacLean. Stay tuned for more of our conversation about his book, Pravda Ha Ha, True Travels to the End of Europe, after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I invite you to sign up for the Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. Find great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. Now, let's get back to my conversation with writer Rory MacLean about his latest book, Pravda Ha Ha, True Travels to the End of Europe. I want to talk about art, because you go to Ukraine, to a place, Dnipro, where there is the Theater of Bad Dreams, and you talk very compellingly about art, the individual, and beauty as things that are sensitive to truth and aware of lies. And this Theater of Bad Dreams is really striking. Tell us about it and about the director, whose mother was pregnant with her when Chernobyl blew up and Chernobyl was nearby. So tell us what had happened to her. I mean, in a way, she's literally an embodiment in her body of the lies of the Soviets. And then she has turned her own experience into a theater troupe that is truly remarkable.
Indeed, yes. this young woman. She was, as you have said, her mother was pregnant and staying not far from Chernobyl when the reactor exploded, and the mother was radiated, and so the young woman, the child, was born with birth defects. But she's one of those individuals we meet who are willing, able, driven to face their incapacities, their problems, and they're determined to get over them. And so she would not suffer fools gladly, as one says. She was determined to live a full life as possible. And she founded the Theater of Bad Dreams. And this is in Ukraine, not so far from the part of Ukraine which certain Russian individuals have been fighting to pull away from the country, the civil war. And so she made up, her whole theater troupe was made up of individuals who had similar, I don't want to say afflictions, had similar burdens, often physical, but also mental. There were many individuals, and emotional, many individuals who had fought in the Donbass region against the Russians and had been wounded or just had post-traumatic stress. And so she formed this company, and in depths of winter, God, it was so cold, I went to this theater in this end of the world. It was a place that sort of felt like the end of Europe. It was so cold. It's during the Soviet Union days, it was the city where most of the USSR's nuclear missiles were made. Indeed, it's speculated now, and I write about this, that North Korea, you'll be aware that about 18 months or 2 years ago, North Korea suddenly had this huge advance in its rocket technology. And it is thought that individuals or plans from Dnipro, from the town, somehow found their way to Pyongyang. But back to the Theater of Bad Dreams. She created this company, this remarkable theater company, and I saw them one very snowy night in an old railway roundhouse.
So this troupe, you know, of people who, you know, the Theater of Bad Dreams. You know, what seems so remarkable is that what they are doing is, let's see, something I heard today that reminds me of it, that if we are not seen, we do not exist, right? And so these are people who are making the truth, whose very bodies, whose very experience of life is telling the truth in a country filled with lies.
Yes, yes.
They are saying, we exist, the truth exists.
Indeed, yeah. Yeah, you've summed it up beautifully. It is one of the ugliest places I have ever seen on the planet. Yet there, in that brutally cold roundhouse, there were these individuals who saw art as a way to heal themselves, who saw confession as a way, as part of the way of healing themselves, as they saw truth for a way to heal themselves.
Exactly. The subtitle of your book is True Travels to the End of Europe, and we can take that as a geographic reference, but we can also, I think, much more importantly, take it as something that you fear, the end of Europe. So tell us more about, you know, your own hopes and dreams here for Europe and your fears for its end, and then what you think we can do to forestall or prevent that conclusion.
What can we do? It's a very good question, Francesca. You know, I was speaking to an individual the other day, and he said to me, he said, "Do you want to know why I think leaving the European Union is such a bad idea? Because my father fought in the Second World War. My grandfather fought in the First World War. I've not had to fight in any war, and that it has been the European Union is flawed. There's no doubt about it, as any human construct is. But it has remarkably brought together for so many years since the 1950s. It has brought together former adversaries, you know, France and Germany, who had warred with each other for centuries. And it's brought them into a community to where individuals respect each other and respect the differences, the diversity, and also honor the past of each country. And what has happened in Britain, of course, Britain is an island, so it's always been part of Europe, but seen itself apart from Europe. But what has happened in Britain is certain individuals, a great many individuals, in the quest for power, have, not unlike President Putin in 1990, I can't remember the mid-1990s, have created myths, stories, the idea that we're almost surrounded by enemies and that Britain has to go it alone. And it's only that way that Britain can survive. And I think it's really tragedy, such a tragedy. But that is what, for better or worse, in the last election, the majority of the country voted for the Conservative Party, and that was their manifesto to get Brexit done. Well, now, as of in just a few hours, it will be done. And so now we in Europe, we have to, I think, turn a page. And certainly those of us who live in Britain, I'm both a Canadian I'm a Canadian who's lived in the UK for many years, as well as Germany. I think there's a very gifted man called Timothy Garton Ash, and he writes about it today. And he writes about the importance of making Brexit a success, but making Europe an even bigger success. So maybe at some time in the future, maybe it's a bit idealistic, but maybe in 10, 20 years, Britain will move back to Europe. Of course, it will be a changed Europe then, because Europe has to recognize that some of the forces which have created the Brexit also are vibrant in France, in Hungary, in Poland. So Europe has to change as well.
Yes. And hear to that. Well, Rory McLean, this has just been such a pleasure to talk with you about this absolutely wonderful book. There's so much, of course, we didn't get to. I encourage my listeners to pick it up. It's beautifully written. It's absolutely spellbinding. Pravda, Ha-Ha, True Travels to the End of Europe. Thank you.
Thank you, Francesca. A real pleasure.
Rory McLean is the author of more than a dozen books, including Stalin's Nose and Under the Dragon. Read an excerpt from his latest, Pravda Ha Ha, by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, the emerging global food crisis caused by COVID-19. Don't go away. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. The COVID-19 pandemic is wreaking havoc on the global economy. Millions are out of work. Supply chains are being disrupted. Many people are already going hungry in the U.S., and many more will face hunger or starvation in other parts of the world. One little recognized factor in the emerging global food crisis is the fact that oil prices have dropped precipitously. We spoke with energy analyst and defense correspondent for The Nation magazine, Michael Clare, about his recent post, COVID-19's Third Shockwave, the Global Food Crisis, to find the link between the drop in oil prices and the food crisis. Michael Clare, your most recent post in The Nation is COVID-19's Third Shockwave, the Global Food Crisis. You say there's a link between the precipitous drop in oil prices and a precipitous rise in food prices in the global south. Explain.
Sure. We tend to think of a drop in petroleum prices as good for consumers, and that's certainly the case under ordinary circumstances. Oil was trading at $60 a barrel at the beginning of this year. It's now down to the 20s or $30 a barrel. And, you know, that'll translate to lower prices at the gas pump, and that's good for the American consumer. But for the producing countries, and I'm talking in particular about countries that depend on petroleum exports for a very large share of their income, this is devastating. Think Venezuela, Nigeria, Angola, Algeria, Libya, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Iraq, and Russia, for example. For these countries, oil exports represent a very large share of their export income and government revenues, because the governments tax these sales, and that's the primary source of their income. And when prices are high, then they spend that money on public works, on food subsidies, fuel subsidies, social welfare benefits for the poor and the middle class, and things are rosy. You think of Venezuela, when prices were high, Hugo Chavez and his Bolivarian Revolution was able to finance a lot of benefits for poor people in Venezuela. And he was very popular at that time. But his successor, Nicolas Maduro, has come in at a time when prices are now dropping at a very low level, and there are sanctions, and there's no money anymore for those subsidies. And people are starving in Venezuela as a consequence. And with this latest price drop, there's no food on the shelves, and people simply are unable to feed their families. The same thing is going to happen in other countries that depend so heavily on oil exports, like Nigeria and Angola. And look at Russia, where Vladimir Putin's popularity is dropping because his ability to provide benefits to the poor and the middle class is also vanishing. Or in Saudi Arabia, which depends on oil exports to support his population. So the decline in oil prices is going to lead to widespread poverty and hunger in many of the oil-producing countries. It's an odd impact of this that we rarely think about.
Yeah, and you also then point out that COVID-19 is going to lead to a number of different crises. I mean, we already have a global health crisis. We have a global economic crisis, and now the global food crisis, of which this drop in oil prices is just one aspect. In fact, you foresee the collapse of global food supply systems and widespread human starvation, even in other countries. Explain that.
Well, this arose out of the research I did for my most recent book, Francesca, the book called All Hell Breaking Loose, about the Pentagon's perspective on climate change. And in research for that book, I read about global food supply chains and global food shocks. We experienced one of those in 2010, 2011. When there were a series of droughts, extreme droughts in Russia, in China, in Australia, in Canada, simultaneously, and Russia stopped selling its grain, and many other countries did so as well. So the price of wheat doubled in a matter of weeks, and this led to a food crisis in importing countries in the Middle East, especially Egypt and Libya and adjoining countries, Tunisia, Syria, where the price of bread doubled overnight. And these are places that eat bread poor people as a major mainstay of their diet. And this is part of what triggered what we call the Arab Spring of 2011. So it was a global food supply crisis caused by conditions occurring around the world and people hoarding food. Well, now the same thing is happening today. That is, countries are beginning to ban exports. Russia, once again, has banned exports of grain products. So is Kazakhstan, Thailand, Cambodia, and Vietnam. So we will start seeing an increase in the global prices of food, which will be very hard on food importing countries in the global south. At the same time, the shipping companies are beginning to find they can't sustain the operations they were able to because of the COVID pandemic. People aren't showing up for work. Port dock loading, you know, that kind of work is risky, and a lot of workers are getting sick or not showing up. So the number of ships is declining. Even in this country, we're seeing a breakdown of food supply chains because meatpacking plants are COVID hotspots and they've had to shut them down. So this is happening on a global scale, and people are going to starve in many parts of the world, either because they can't get food or because the price is so high.
And you also point to a second issue, which is that farmers are reporting that they can't find customers for their crops because restaurants are closing. Processing plants, as you say, are going idle. Although I know that Trump is trying to force the meatpacking plants open, I'm not sure he's going to be able to succeed in that. And that this is resulting, you know, we've all seen the plowing under of fresh vegetables and the dumping of milk and other scarcities. So I wonder if you could talk about that aspect too. And what are the implications for, you know, our food supply system going forward? What can we do about this?
Well, this is where we need a lot more activism at the local level by local officials and state officials, because clearly the federal government is unable to get its act together on any of this, despite all the talk from the White House. Farmers in my part of the world, in New England, there are a lot of dairy farmers producing milk, but schools are closed and they're not ordering milk supplies like they used to. The universities are closed, so they have a surplus of milk and there's no way to get it to the consumers, the food banks that are in need. Now, there are volunteer organizations and food banks that are trying to take up the slack, and we need a lot more volunteer effort in this area to connect farmers to the food banks. But of course, it's a difficult time. It's a challenging time. Many people, many volunteers themselves are elderly or retired and fearful about getting outside. So we're going to need a real dedicated effort by municipal and state officials to take on this task.
And so finally, do you see that, you know, as we see so much of our governmental institutions failing around us and this global supply system, as you say, breaking down, what opportunities do you see, you know, in the medium and the long term for reorganization that might be more resilient in the world that we're coming into?
Well, thank you, Francesca, for asking that. And I'm hardly alone in saying this, that as a consequence of this, one thing we've learned is the importance of localism and local resiliency. I see that in my area in Western Massachusetts, where the food co-op plays a very important role because it works directly with local farmers to get their produce to the marketplace where we're able to obtain food directly, you know, from farmers. We're going to need a lot more local institutions based in the community that take on tasks of health and welfare rather than depend on a distant federal government, which isn't doing a very good job at taking care of us.
Yes, hear. I agree with you. I just rejoined my local community-supported agriculture farm because I know I'll be able to get enough food from them this summer, barring at least any bad weather that might be a problem with that. Michael, Claire, I want to thank you so much for talking with us again. Two articles, recent articles in The Nation. COVID-19 is forcing us to rethink how we consume energy. And COVID-19's third shockwave, the global food crisis. Thanks again. We look forward to calling you up again. This conversation has just been so interesting. Thank you.
Thank you for giving me this chance to discuss these issues, Francesca. Always a pleasure.
That was Michael Clare talking about his recent post for The Nation, COVID-19's third shockwave, the global food crisis. And go to writersvoice.net for our interview with him about COVID-19's impact on the global oil market and what it bodes for renewable energy. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.